at 8 p.m. Visit lifffest.org.uk for details.
Hello, I'm William English, and you are listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. This week's guest is Resonance Programming Director Ed Baxter. Thank you, Ed, for coming on to the show.
My pleasure.
Before we get on to the important issue of the future of broadcasting, which I know you are reticent to pronounce upon, I thought we might build up a sort of an identikit picture of you for the listeners.
Okay, where would you like to start?
Exactly what I was going to say. Where should we start?
My jaw, perhaps.
Your jaw?
I noticed that in an old photo, my jaw was a different shape because I had my wisdom teeth out at the age of 22.
Right, okay. And, well, let's go a bit further back. What did you want to do when you left school, and what did you actually do?
Well, I remember we had a careers meeting, maybe around the age of 16, in an act of a sort of perversion, but also really addressing the kind of thing I wanted to do. I told the careers officer I wanted to be a concrete poet.
Really?
I was very fascinated by typography.
Yeah.
And was quite a swot when it came to reading about Fluxus and Kurt Schwitters and Joseph Beuys, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And what I really wanted to do was go to art school when I left school. But I didn't, because my mother worked at an art school and thought that everybody who went there turned into useless drunks.
Right. Was she right?
Well, without wanting to disparage the people she worked with, there was a fair amount of boozing going on, which, as a teenager, I was sort of immune to. So I didn't drink myself, obviously, in the mid-70s. Middle-class lads like me didn't go near booze or cigarettes, really. But
Where was this? Whereabouts?
I was brought up in Raines Park, which is now called West Wimbledon, and
yeah,
an estate agent's sleight of hand.
Yeah.
And my mother was working at Wimbledon Art School and later at Camberwell Art School as the student services officer. She wasn't teaching art. She was helping people with psychological problems and housing and that kind of thing.
Hmm.
But I remember as a schoolboy going to an exhibition of Michelangelo drawings at the British Museum and encountering the painter Neil Stokoe.
Yeah.
In the first antechamber, who was a prodigious, is still a prodigious painter in the kind of Bacon tradition, but who also had a reputation as a hellraiser, but who very kindly led me round the exhibition, enthusing about the quality of the drawing in a loud, demonstrative manner that was not only extremely impressive, but also, which I think was important, didn't patronise me in a way that my school teachers almost invariably did. I think probably out of habit as much as inclination.
Mm.
And I think I wanted to not to be that kind of person, but to somehow enter that kind of environment. And around the same time, which had been 1976, maybe 1977, that kind of a years, I started going up to central London and Most Saturdays I'd catch the train up to London and just wander around looking at buildings, not really going into shops very much. So I don't think you went into shops unless you had money in those days. So I'd just wander the streets and go to art galleries. First of all, the public museums, and then to the private galleries. And at that
was
age,
it sort of Cork Street, that sort of area? Or?
Well, at that time I didn't know that there were such things as private views. I remember going to the Anthony Doffé Gallery on the afternoon of what must have been the private view for one of Joseph Beuys's exhibitions, an installation, and he was there with a piano tuner, and the piano tuner was tuning the grand piano. And
I think I remember that show. It was where the walls were all lined with grey felt. Yeah, you have to sort of duck down to get into it. Yeah, that was on Deering Street, I think.
Yes, that would have been right. And I didn't know the etiquette, so I wandered into the gallery. I looked around, said hello. I'd like to pretend I had an incredibly detailed conversation with Joseph Beuys, but of course he merely said hello back and was plodding along with his work. And then eventually a gallery person told me that they weren't open until the next day. And then, many years later, I read that Beuys thought that the arrival of the piano tuner at a particular work, I don't know if it was that work, signified the kind of beginning of the installation. So that memory has stuck in my mind in an abstract way, certainly not as forcefully as Neil Stokoe's exposition of Michelangelo.
What about music? Were you at school, were you kind of involved with music at all?
Well, at the same time, again, 1975, 1976, a group of us formed a band in big quote marks, I would say, absolute ramshackle shambles of a band, which varied between 3 and 7 people. And 3 of us entered the school music competition and did a kind of extremely repetitive, boring piece of music, very devoid of virtuosity, which the...
Deliberately boring?
Yes, the idea was to do, I suppose, what we would be listening to. I'm not sure we'd even heard any Fluxus music. Maybe we had, and we'd probably heard...
So when you say band, was this guitars and drums, or were you already into...
Guitars and piano. Yeah, electric guitar, acoustic guitar and piano.
Right.
The singer ducked out at the last minute, so it was a trio, and the music teacher eventually stopped it after about 9.5 minutes. He'd had enough, and so had everybody else. And the kids who knew how to play instruments were baffled and outraged. And the art teacher, whose name I think was Mr. Cuthbert, and who I should really Google if I could remember his first name, he was very impressed. And he used to encourage us to do happenings and collages and all that kind of stuff. And Gordon Crosby, the ceramics teacher, was extremely encouraging and encouraged me to do... I did an awful lot of ceramics in my teens, and up until about the age of 28, I even exhibited some ceramics at some point.
So there were already... You already had a sort of diversity of interests. You were kind of... it sounds like you weren't actually focusing on one particular... pursuit.
Why I studied English at university.
So that's what you actually did.
Well, I think I was quite pretentious, I suppose, as a teenager. And I remember I didn't study history after O-level because I thought I should try something else. So I ended up studying, I think, Latin at A-level, which was a very peculiar thing to do even then. My parents, who were quite arty, not very bohemian, but they listened to Stockhausen and Kurt Weill, as well as Noel Coward and Kathleen Ferrier. And my father was obsessed with both Kurt Schwitters and Eric Gill. They persuaded me against my nature, really, that I should get a degree at university and then I could go to art school. But in fact, what happened was at university, I just stuck with English for a very long time. I ended up doing a PhD.
Where was this?
I was at King's College in London,
oh, right.
The Strand.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was doing the PhD, which was on Thomas de Quincey, I accidentally became an installation artist. And even more accidentally, my mother phoned me up to tell me that I was the lead feature in a review by William Fever, who was the very influential, or the then mid-80s influential art critic for The Observer.
Right.
And briefly, in the days before Damien Hirst and the YBAs, I was part of a group who people like William Fever thought were the future of British art, which is quite funny. But we sort of...
So when you say accidentally, how did this come about?
It happened because my old school friend Simon Dickerson, who was the vocalist who didn't turn up at the music competition, was studying architecture with Glyn Banks and Hannah Vowles, who worked as the duo Art in Ruins.
Oh, yes, I know.
And they were teaching at Kingston Poly, and they did a what they called an overhung show where they invited too many people to exhibit and you had to kind of force your work into the space. It was a collaboration with an Iranian artist, I think it was in Iran, Hercules Fisherman, who seemed to have...
Yes.
I'm not sure he had a lot of money. He certainly had expensive clothes. But he was one of those people who get hold of spaces and silk screens and had a studio and was kind of a bit wacky and open to ideas. So I ended up collaborating with Simon, who maybe he was short of ideas or just nervous about exhibiting any work. But we did this really big, ugly... sculptural thing with lots of text on the back and barbed wire and human hair. I still got a rug of human hair in my loft somewhere. And I suppose it was so grotesque that it stood out among the paintings, and it was designed to wind people up, I think, really. But it was
really?
Taken very seriously, as I said.
So you were trying to be provocative with it, you think?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I had, you know, the barbed wire, people snagged their clothing on.
Oh,
and
right.
it was sort of a nasty piece of work. Yeah. as indeed I was at that time, I think.
Really? I don't... Yeah. You're very self-deprecating so far. I think you describe yourself as pretentious and now a nasty piece of work.
Well, around the same, shortly after the I forget what the show is called, Our Wonderful Culture, Art in Ruins, I think. I kind of fell in with Glyn and Hannah and with Stuart Holm, who I met there.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of thought we were the Sex Pistols or something, I think, in some level. I don't know. Why? I think we thought we were much cleverer than everybody else. And the reason we got on was some imp of the perverse. So that Glyn Banks, for example, I remember buying a glass of Perrier water when Perrier water was new and exclusively bought a glass of Perrier water to throw in the face of Matthew Collings, the critic. And then they had a fight and the bouncers accidentally threw out the critic rather than the artist. Very bad faux pas.
It turned out well then.
Yeah. And I remember walking down Cork Street at the Cork Street party, spitting on every car window in Cork Street and picking fights with people. And
really?
Generally...
What, physical fights?
Yeah, and generally kind of being not the sort of person you'd want to spend any time with, I don't think.
Was this alcohol induced, or you were just a bit aggressive? Or?
It was. I suppose to do with the circumstances. Yeah,
right.
Cheap, other people's cheap booze when they had too much money, and we wanted to We wanted to pick fights, I think, actually.
Right. Interesting.
It was a weird time. A lot of it I've repressed, obviously.
All right.
Out of good taste.
So was radio important to you as a youth? I mean, what were your radio moments that kind of... Perhaps it wasn't that significant at that time, really.
Well, it was, because we didn't have many records. I didn't buy my first record until I was in employment, which would have been maybe 1978. And I still don't have a vast record collection. Mm. And I used to, the money I earned, I used to have to pay to my parents for rent. So I think I was a bit snobbish. So I didn't buy lots of punk records. I only bought the Big in Japan EP and one or two other things. You know. I thought The Fall peaked after their second single, so I don't have any Fall records after.
Yeah,
It's the New Anything, I don't think.
Right.
So, and also in the early 70s, when everybody was in the playground talking about television, it's a kind of daily pastime. My brother kicked over our television when he was playing with the cat,
right,
and the cathode ray snapped in two, and that was that. We didn't have money to buy another television a long time, maybe 5 years, I think. So we'd listen to a lot of radio, but you know, my parents liked Round the Horn and the Clitheroe Kid, those kind of things you'd hear regularly. And I can still remember entire monologues from Round the Horn that I only heard once, because I think my brothers and sister and I would repeat Rambling Sid Rumpole's songs and stuff.
Yes.
And then later I was a bit... The way that Prince Charles absorbed the Goons, I think I understood the structural gags of people like Kenny Everett on a sort of unconscious level. He used to do things like he'd give away a Renault as a prize, and there'd be a very elaborate competition stage, and the Renault would, of course, be a toy car, but he would carry off these gags very, very elegantly, actually. It was a kind of contrast to his ghastly television persona. And then in the 70s, mid-70s, I would listen a lot to Anne Nightingale's show, which, because she played krautrock, actually, more than John Peel did.
Right.
So you'd hear Kraftwerk and Neu and Can on that kind of show. And I'd be studying for my O-levels while listening to that kind of music, some of which I still listen to occasionally. Not very much these days, I must say.
And so then I think you were involved in the small press publishing scene, I think, weren't you, for a while? Or is that much later? Is that sort of... Perhaps I'm jumping ahead.
That was a while later. That would maybe the very late 80s.
All right.
Sort of after the art stuff peaked in maybe 87, 88, something like that. But you know, before that, I'd been publishing pamphlets from about 1985, I was involved in publishing, and tried my hand at bookselling and typesetting to earn a living, which I did for a while. I started a mail order company with Andy Hopton called Counter Productions, and we tried to do, I suppose, what Recommended Records was doing, but with underground publications. So I would bump into people like Ed Pinsent when he was still a comics magnate, as it were. John Michel and John Nicholson, the people from Atlas Press.
Right.
Even the 14 Times, when it was still something that Bob Rickard did as a hobby. So we distributed around London things like that, and also Stuart Holmes' Smile magazine. And Stephen Shelkin's pamphlets and Graham Harwood's comics and so on and so forth. And then we started importing stuff from the States that we knew would sell, actually, from Semiotext and that that ghastly man, what's his name? Adam Parfrey, Ferrell House.
Mm.
I say ghastly, just sort of politically dodgy, but
yeah. So when did the involvement with the London Musicians Collective start?
Well, that really came out of typesetting. I had run some concerts at King's College as an undergraduate. I was sort of bored with, that's terrible to say it now, isn't it? I was sort of bored with a lot of music after this heat broke up. I sort of felt something was lost, and then the pop group broke up as well, didn't it? And that probably all around the same time. Mm. And then by about 1980, it seemed that a lot of the music venues had decided to promote stand-up comedy.
Mm.
And I don't know, I was disgruntled and pernickety kind of person. So I put on some gigs at King's College and then sort of tried to avoid promoting music after that because it seemed like a lot of hard work. But by about 1989 or 1990, I was typesetting the LMC's newsletter, and all I seemed to be typesetting were recriminations and complaints and messages of despair.
So you gravitated towards the LMC. You thought, I want to be part of the experimental music scene. You kind of...
Well, I was hanging out with people like Rob Murphy and Lepke Bookwater, and those kind of people, who I suppose were on the very fringes of the LMC. And we also with people like John Wynne, who I really met through the art scene rather than music. And I had this plan, Rob and I had a plan, to get hold of the bus garage in Camberwell. It was been empty for a few years, and turn it into a music venue. And we thought, well, the LMC could do with a home. I actually had the keys to this building, and the fire officer was inspecting it. And, you know, I had it for about 3 days.
Mm.
And then the council and the bus people changed their mind. But I also thought, from my experiences with the Small Press Fair, which was an annual event, that what the LMC needed to do was to run an annual festival, and that after maybe 3 years, it would have established itself as a big thing on an international calendar. And I was quite keen on players like Tom Cora, I suppose, or Eugene Chadbourne, sort of people who were minor stars in the international scene, but who rarely appeared in London, and were the kind of people I wanted to see perform for reasons that are now obscure to me.
So maybe once again we should perhaps scotch the myth that John Peel was in any way responsible for the formation of Resonance. I mean, it was in the air, wasn't it, before? If you read the Resonance issue, which came out, Retuning Radio, in 1997, which predates the Meltdown Festival by a year. I mean, it was already in the air, this idea of a radio station.
The idea was Phil England's idea. And it would have been... We'd initially planned it for the Laurie Anderson Meltdown, which was the previous year. So the Retuning Radio issue has a strategic interview with Laurie Anderson in it.
Right.
But either the funding or the South Bank Centre or Laurie Anderson herself weren't committed to it. And so it was delayed a year, essentially.
Uh-huh.
But it took a couple of years to bring together. The delay wasn't entirely negative because it meant we got a lot more material in, but the idea was really Phil's because he was sort of swatting up on radio theory. I was just the person who did a lot of the paperwork and was the point of contact with David Sefton at the South Bank, and who could typeset the newspaper and sort of odd job man, really. But I don't think until it was well underway in terms of Phil gathering the material that was the basis of the 1998 RSL, the International Gallery of Radio Art. I didn't really give radio any thought whatsoever. And then I wondered why nobody at school had told me how easy it was to make a career out of radio, thinking of the guys at Radio 3 now. And then another stage of learning was on the first day of the RSL broadcast, walking away from the Royal Festival Hall and actually leaving the project behind and realising that I didn't have to be responsible for it in the way that I was for festivals and concerts. I managed to find some kind of middle ground that allowed me to extricate myself from it, whereas I think with the RSL, Phil was very very much engaged with it to the point where I suspect he tried to stay up for a month and listen to everything and just keep on top of everything.
Yeah,
which I think sort of perhaps ruined it for him ultimately.
You said that you're reticent to talk about the future of radio, as Resonance is the future of radio. Do you think there's a danger that the ideas of Resonance might be absorbed into the mainstream, into other stations, and sort of how will it retain its, I don't know, what do you call it, its edge? Or its
We noticed, Phil and I, when we were reading the 1998 manifesto, that we'd predicted that single month would overturn the entire philosophy of the BBC. And in fact, it hasn't done anything for the BBC. So I think on the one hand, it's the monolithic, torpid nature of those institutions that is retarding radio. Another point would be that I'd be quite happy if the ideas of Resonance were absorbed into the mainstream. If the mainstream actually was worth listening to, that would be good.
Is there an aspect of Resonance which could not be absorbed? Is there anything that cannot be?
The professionals couldn't afford to do what we do. You know, if you and I were being paid for this conversation, that would, if there's money pouring into the thing, it all becomes this reflex of marketing and financial concerns. So just as there are things that we can't do because we don't have money, there are things that the mainstream broadcasters can't do because they do.
Because they're answerable.
Kind of financial base, yeah.
Mm. But
I think it works. And I do get bored with conferences and Guardian articles about the future of radio as though we hadn't already left the others behind a long time ago, so that our 1998 ambition to overturn the BBC, well, we just made them appear irrelevant as far as I'm concerned. And I don't say that out of any personal arrogance. I say it because the skills and talents of the people who use Resonance as a resource are kind of offer a completely different vision and a different sound to what has gone before it.
We're rapidly running out of time. I'm amazed, actually, because I was going to ask you about your performance piece. You recently did a performance piece, and I think I've seen a photograph of you. You look like you're crucified, naked, covered in newspapers. Is that a correct sort of interpretation?
I wasn't actually crucified. I assumed
you're in a sort of cruciform position.
On top of a metal chair on a very cold day in February, up against a metal security wall in the yard at the Arts Centre Beaconsfield.
Yes.
And that was my contribution to the Gustav Metzger, Rodri Davis self-cancellation conference day. And I knew because I was organising the conference that nobody else was doing any performance. And I'm not a fan of performance art at all, but I thought that it would be quite funny and peculiar to end the day with a performance. And I thought, I can't be bothered persuading anybody else to do it. And then I thought, well, I've read far too much about the Vienna Actionists. I wonder what happens when you do something like this. So I forced myself against my better judgment to do it. And in fact, I was naked except for a few bits of The Guardian, and people threw raw eggs at me, and it was terrifying. Yeah, absolutely terrifying. But Gustav Metzger said it was very beautiful, and
the image is very memorable. Actually,
a lot of other people
it's a striking
could laugh at it. Mm. So I was happy and sort of empowered by it.
I'm rapidly running out of time. Thank you very much, Ed, for coming on and being so
pleasure.
Open.
Let's do it again.
We might have to do it again because I've got about another 2 pages of questions, actually. So we might have to do a follow-up to this if you're game for it.
Okay.
All goodbye. Right. Well, thank you very Have much. Thank you. And we'll play out now with a track from Resonance Magazine, Resonance Radio issue from 1997.
Millennium, Part 1, Jihad. When two set out to dine or duel together, a third appears. Tertium quid, parasite, witness, prophet, escapee. 5 years ago, it still remained possible to occupy a third position in the world.
On Sunday the 29th of June, Club Integral is at the Hackney Empire, with music from Graham Massey's Toolshed, Lotus Petals, Ayama Kamura, and fresh from the Glastonbury Festival, Mozambique's number one band, Masukos. Doors open at 7 p.m. Entry is £12.50 or £10 in advance. Call 0208 985 2424, that's 0208 985 2424, or visit divineagency.org for details. Club Integral, Hackney Empire, Sunday, June the 29th.
This is Resonance FM. My name's Cecilia Wee, and you're listening to the second part of Art and War Series 2, a 5-part series exploring representations and cultural understandings of war and militarised combat. This week I present an interview with BBM, German art collective who've been working with weapons of political control.